Hello, this is Pearl Lamb Podcast. I'm sitting here in London in my friend's wonderful apartment. And then I'm sitting here with the lovely Cleo Roberts coming ready. And I just met her this year, actually. This year or last year?
End of last year, was it?
End of last year. Very recent. Not even a year of friendship. Mm. But the day I met her, I like her. So, Cleo, can you tell the audience a brief summary about yourself?
So, well, I feel like the tables have turned because I first interviewed you for the FT, and I'm a writer, and I'd say I write about a lot of art, and I explore and I'm interested in art from a truly international perspective. So that manifests in me writing articles, books. I have a podcast called Art Worlds. And I've also sort of spent time doing a PhD, which looked at historic forms of representation in India. I think that's a brief top line. That's top line.
Oh, no, but you also give lectures.
I give lectures. I have been doing some research actually on maternity, sort of pay and things in the art world. So I'm a curious individual. Which most people you interview are, I think.
You're more than that, much more than that. You study art history.
Yeah, along with anthropology, which I think is kind of key to the way I see the world now.
Yeah, very different. Because, I mean, first thing is, let's talk about your studies. Why do you choose art history first?
I think actually it chose me. That's a bit cheesy, but I originally was going to study English linguistics because I loved words. Like, I've always been obsessed with words, and I've always written. I was writing poetry. I created a magazine at my primary school. You know, I was always really interested in expressing myself through words, which naturally sort of took me to discover linguistics. But I wanted to go to Durham. They had an amazing course and they cancelled it. So then I ended up doing this program where you could do modules in art history along with anthropology, kind of a bit more like an American combined, it was called Combined Social Sciences. And that opened my eyes to the importance of not only like material culture, which anthropology sort of focuses on, but also the way we see and the power of seeing. And that's something that I have to thank one of my, you know, lecturers who he'd written about this amazing Russian artist called Natalie Goncharova, who was a really pioneering female artist. And he made me realise that through artwork, through visual expression, we could learn so much about the world and about power that's embedded within, like, visual structures. So that's kind of... it was my start. And it's gone on. It's gone on and on. And it will go on and on.
So let me ask you this question, okay? Modernism. We talk about modernism. Yeah. Modernism is saying that you cut the past. You cut the history. Let's restart. Now, you study art history. Now we look at the contemporary art. What do you think about you know, today's contemporary art? We are talking about conceptual art. Conceptual art, which is nothing. They don't want anything to do with history. I remember there was a curator. There was someone who told me about the art world curator coming in. And he said to me, you know, this is a very interesting curator because... Mm. He said, you know, the background is art history. I said, why? He said, you know, today, most curator is about, we read psychology, philosophy, and sociology. We don't want to study art history because it detours us to appreciate the concept.
Interesting.
What do you think about these comments?
So, because there's a lot to unravel there.
Yeah.
Because I
argue with that a lot.
Yeah, I think...
Not especially when it relates to Chinese art.
Yeah, so I would... This was going to be my first point. I think that we are in a world now where we're more alive and we've awoken to the fact that modernism was not just a movement in America. So you've got to think about modernism in the most expansive terms. And modernism in America happened a certain time. In India, where I'm very familiar with, it happened at a totally different time. And it did respond very, very sharply to political circumstances and a past which included the experience of colonial power.
But how about modernism in European sense? Because they use the modernism, the word modernism, yeah, to look at art. Modernism art is to say that this is a new chapter, completely new. Cut all these things about the birth, the baggage of, yeah, and of the past, the baggage of history.
Is anything ever new? Like there's an amazing psycholinguist called Steven Pinker. And he writes about the fact that our brain relatively has not evolved since man first came about. So I would argue that we are so connected to who we were then. And I mean, that's why I love history, because I can see our world has really not changed that much. Yeah, like, we're just using different tools. Like, and that's another of his points, is that like our brains really haven't changed. We've just, the things around us often change the tools, but fundamentally, physically, there were theories that we might, our thumbs are getting bigger because of all the texting, and that might happen. But again, in the long view, fundamentally, we're still very connected to who we were. And if you look,
yes,
I think about this all the time. Terms like, we talk about now immersive art. I'm studying cave paintings that were immersive art in their truly original form.
All for the younger generation.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah. You go to somewhere, again, some of these caves that around the world, you could walk in and you are literally immersed. You're overwhelmed. Yes. But you've been to many of these caves. Like, yes, we talked about it in India, like Ajanta. Like, it's extraordinary. And these people, you can strike up an emotional connection with them. William Dalrymple writes fantastically about this. You can connect with them. Yeah. You can see that they were obsessed with the bling, you know, similar to what I might wear. You know, they had dripping. The bling. Yeah. and so I find that to be this idea of cutting from the past, I think, in my worldview, is very naive, because I also think we inherit a lot.
Yeah, because I think Chinese art, you know, with our long civilization, you cannot just cut. I mean, I always believe in the Chinese contemporary art, a lot of the artists is evolving from the historical part, evolving to speak about what is happening, you know. And even if they do conceptual on politics, it is an evolution. And how from the imperial China to today.
And how can you make something that isn't related to the time you're in? The materials that are available to you
absolutely
are because of the time you're in. And they also depend on histories of manufacture. Often sort of like there's a fantastic Filipino couple who make works with items that would never have been in their, you know, in the Philippines sort of material circuits had it not been for the politics of, again, colonialism and then the Commonwealth, you know? So
yeah. So Cleo, share with the audience why Indian art, why you're so curious about Indian art, and you're going to write a book about it as well. So share with us.
I ask myself that all the time. I think I went there when I was very young, and I was quite literally blown away. And I just, you know, when you enter into something and you're just scrambling to make sense of it. And I think that's what really led me down to this path. And there's also a moment where I visited a performance art space in Goa. It was in a ex-Portuguese villa. Exquisite, like sort of, you know, kind of ceramic-y tiles and this pale sort of lemony yellow and all the kind of fluting. And inside there are these performance artists, and it was led by an artist who I've, again, followed since I was really young, called Nikhil Chopra, who's going to be curating the Kochi Biennale this year.
Wow.
Who I'm sure he's going to do an amazing job. And here I was faced with works that I had never experienced that sort of shock. And emotional reaction that I did when I was in this villa and seeing, like, wow. It was like an evening of performances. And I just remember thinking, I don't really like this, but why don't I like it? And then also, actually, is that my kind of rejection of it almost me admitting my ignorance? And I just needed to know more. And then I just talked to people, stayed with artists, have like lifelong friends from that experience. And we just unpack the world. And I also think that part of the Indian connection was that gave me a route in, and it's a very like slight route, was the fact that the British were in power there. And, you know, I've had people think that I'm from a colonial family, which I'm certainly not. Like, I have a kind of a German background, actually. And I think that gave me a kind of conduit in, because I was trying to understand how you overlay these two very different cultures. And it's not even overlay, like, it's a very oppressive, like...
distinctly different.
Yeah, it's an oppression. It's not an overlay. That's much too generous word. But... how did that happen? And then how do you have this country now that's really thriving in many ways? In many ways, it's really not. And it just opened up a world that I just needed to know about.
But then it's not just being curious. You actually want to... you are studying the whole Indian art history.
Yeah.
And Indian art history is substantially and distinctly different from the Renaissance until now.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's had moments of its own flourishing. Like, as in, there are moments in India's history where people talk about the Bengal Renaissance. And, yeah, it's so at odds with the touchstones that I would have had in my education in England. And that's also, like, I remember doing a... I did my... God, it's going way back. My undergrad dissertation on Yinka Shanabari, who you've worked with. And... that, again, what attracted me to his work was that he was so beautifully, and he makes beautiful work, unearthing all these connections that I was never taught about. And, like, you're still not really taught about, or it's given a very palatable gloss. And so I think there's a line between that research that I was doing and then, doing my PhD when I spent lots of time in India. Yeah, it's... and it will go on because, you know, the more you discover, the more you realise how ignorant you are.
So we have been talking about the art world in general when we last met. And the art world is not exactly very exciting today. And how about in your academic art world? How was it like? Is there quiet time?
I think I like to be really positive. Like, I generally look for the great
positive,
in things.
Yeah.
But I also recognise that I think we're at an inflection point where all these wonderful powers and, you know, wonderful phenomena are coming together. So my world, like, I'm a woman of the printed word and I hold on to that very dearly. You know, I've got, you know... piles of books everywhere. They're stored at anyone's house so I can get some books in. There are books there. But I recognise that the way we're consuming information is changing, the way information is being produced, like knowledge. I think you have to, you know, make a difference between knowledge and like wisdom and understanding and being able to synthesise all this information that we're being fed. So in terms of writing in academia, I think, like, I say I'm a recovering academic because I didn't take on an institutional role. I was very clear that I couldn't do that because I recognised that the things that I loved about learning were really not being... they were being, like, very rapidly devalued. And you see this now, like, an academic lifestyle is really difficult to maintain. If you're part of the younger guard. And so...
it's difficult to maintain. Is it because there's the job opportunities is very... I mean, there's less job opportunities.
Yeah. And I think, especially in the arts, like, you've got to think about... if you think about education as a whole, the arts are you know, so far down on the agenda. And I appreciate why. In many respects, like in many countries, there are sort of more practical, you know, people sort of first and foremost want to solve kind of medical problems. I totally understand that. But there's still room for art and creative thinking. And I think I would also think that a lot of the skills you learn when you're studying art, like the sort of visual analysis, are so important across many, many different industries.
Okay. Today with AI, right?
Yeah.
So does this AI help you? I mean, what is it? I mean, we were talking about the impact of technology, impact of AI. What do you think? What's your comments on it?
I mean, obviously, we all use it all the time.
Yeah.
Like, unwittingly.
Do you think that the AI would be taking over?
I think there's so much we don't know. So
we don't know.
The head of DeepMind, he gave a really great interview. Like, very candid. He won a Nobel recently, fine. But what came across was that it's all speculation, like so much of this. And Tim Berners-Lee, who, you know, was the kind of father of the internet as we know it, he years ago wrote an open letter saying, like, we've really got to understand about regulation, about ethics. Like, none of us planned for this. None of us imagined that the internet, let alone AI, would get to the stage it's got at, and then to retrospectively, you know, plug all the holes, that's a thankless job. So AI, like, I think it's unavoidable, and I think obviously everyone uses it to a different end.
I mean, technology advancement. Yeah. We should actually take advantage of it.
Yeah, and it has helped.
You know, how much we can take advantage and then what is the ethics point. Because yesterday I was reading that now AI is, you know, American military is getting AI to make weapons.
Yeah.
And get into war. So it becomes a very dangerous thing. But we're going back to this, to the technology, because I think now it's like the lowest of lowest in the art market. So everyone is looking at technology, the impact of and of technology. But a lot of people is thinking that, wow, we can't see the end. So people are getting nervous.
Yeah.
At the same time, they feel that because there's such a huge technology advancement, we don't know where we stand. We don't know how. Do you really need a gallery or do you not need a gallery? These are these basic questions.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about it?
So I was reading a report the other day. I've been very interested in when the USB report came out. Obviously, they identified that the top ends of the market are really struggling. But then there's this like been this efflorescence at the lower end with prints and things. And there's this very interesting company called Avante Art who do prints by like big name artists. Like they did Grayson Perry and I think they've done recently with Carrie Mae Wins, I think. So anyway, they do these prints, and what they're finding is that within 24 hours, they can sell enough prints to donate £1 million to LACMA. Okay, so that's technology. Like, that's a form of technology being used really positively in the art world. Yeah. And then they also say that their clients, who now identify themselves as art collectors, really value museum experiences. So,
no, but I was, you know, I talked to several museums. Their museums today, they are saying that the younger generation, the Gen Z, they are not visiting.
Yeah.
Because they want immersive experience. So every of these big museum who used to show Renaissance or the old paintings, they all started to do some very popular artists show. So that to attract the Gen Z. Because all Gen Z wants is immersive art. I mean, they're not so interested.
Possibly.
Oh, but, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but I hate saying what's wrong with that. be.
There's nothing wrong. I think you know the world evolved, taste evolved.
Yeah.
And then of course the museum are getting very worried because they can't sell the tickets. They're worried about patron. They worry about a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And like the recent Tate data that came out a few weeks ago, and like Tate Modern, Maria Bauschel identified that their biggest area where they're seeing problems of bounce back figures is that younger generation.
Yeah, because younger generation love to visit Team Lab.
Yeah.
Because it's all that immersive experiences. Mm. Mm. All right. And then now they don't want to. So all the museum are now finding pop. They want popular artists to draw.
Yeah.
Yeah. The visitors.
So, like, who would you consider? So, like, a Team Lab, fine, like, random team international. Team Lab,
you know, in the Bath Holborn Museum last year, they have Mr. Doodle.
Yeah.
They said that they never have so many visitors.
Yeah.
So, all that are changing the direction because they do need younger generation visitors. Mm. Just because the older, you know, and also the younger visitors has to be, you know, in the West, there's a lot of people. There's a big study saying that the younger generation in the West, they don't want to pay. They don't, you know, if the parents give them a huge collection, they're most likely to sell everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because they don't want to pay the insurance. They don't want to have the time to manage it. They don't want it.
Mm.
So what they want is they'd rather to fly around the world to have these great experiences than to look after or manage the collection.
Yeah.
So that is changing. That's a generational shift in Northern America and Western Europe.
Yeah.
That's a big shift. I look at my part of the world because they don't inherit from the parents. They want to build their own collection. They're going back to good old days, Europe or America.
Yeah.
So I always said that there will be a geographical change, shift as well. But people are getting very worried in the art world because no one can see the end.
Yeah. So
I think that's
the great wealth transfer, which obviously the art market are very concerned about because
very concerned.
That's like their collector base. That is going to be fascinating.
And also the museum are worried that these younger generation is not going to donate.
Yeah, and the patronage, and I think also...
The patronage, money is all dry. This is the whole big worry about the big art world today. Mm.
And I think, especially in the UK right now, we're in a hot mess, you know, because a lot of patrons...
The government has cut the fundings.
Yeah, and the patronage that a lot of these places relied on, a lot of the people who supplied that are also leaving the UK. And often you want to support something that you can frequent, whereas, you know, if you're not here, you're less likely to support. So they're going to, people are going to have to, I suppose, be more innovative. But I would argue, Will, that the sort of going, the physical experience, like, as I said, you know, maybe I'm a romantic, but the physics experience, I think that won't ever change. Whether you're going to an immersive experience, you're still going somewhere, you're still traveling somewhere. So that is a positive to me.
It is positive, but
people
the
aren't
thing
lost
is,
in there.
But immersive and coming to a museum, seeing paintings, putting in a wall is very different.
Yeah, yeah. But then,
so do you think the museum is going to adapt to that?
Well, if you look in London at the moment,
no, the immersive exhibition is very expensive.
Yeah, yeah, and we also have experiences that definitely aren't art. So when David Hockney does his immersive experience, it's not an art. I don't think people in the art world see it as an art exhibition per se. And they have, you know, dinosaurs on at the moment in that same room.
Oh, dinosaurs people would visit because it's for the family affairs, right?
But then I also think that maybe we also have to go a bit further, like down the kind of chain about art education, which has also been, you know, relatively decimated in this country. And in, you know, other countries, it's not, you know, we were lucky that we had it as part of a state curriculum. In other countries, that isn't even, like, on the table type of thing. So I think also that if you're not exposed to how magical an experience with art can be, then you are going to be less likely to appreciate a painting on a wall. Like,
no, but a lot of people buying painting doesn't mean that they appreciate painting in a wall. It's about social circle. Yeah, it's about their ego.
Yeah.
And there's many, many different reasons for them to and to collect. But today, because of these changes, because of technology impact, everybody's like this. And of course, the economy has a big impact, right?
Yes. And also, ideas of museums as well come from a very specific location in the world and from a very specific time. And I also find that really funny that we're still obsessed with the idea of museums. Yeah. And like, I've been working with people and talking to them, like in India, there's this flourishing of private museums. I mean, across the world, Georgina Adam wrote a brilliant book about it, the rise and rise of private museums. Like, you know, people want museums.
Yeah.
Could do other things, couldn't we?
Yeah, but what do you think? Is it, I mean, many people said that, when do you think the art world will resurrect? I always say that, when the economy resurrect?
Yeah.
Art will resurrect.
Or is it changing, you know, like...
it is changing. It is changing because I think change is a must because the whole world is changing.
Yeah.
Taste is changing.
Yeah. I mean, on a fundamental level, we're changing all the time,
exactly.
Physically. But I suppose the thing that I think people are very excited about in the moment in the art market is, you know, the few kind of dealers, particularly in America, who are shutting up shop after having very long, fantastic careers. And Tim Schneider wrote a brilliant piece in the FT recently about this idea of the age of empire being over. And are we actually now building much more local communities? And so are we going to see that restructuring? And I know from like places in London that are like the really young galleries, like they are doing things,
How do they survive?
I don't know. I admire them so much. It's,
you know, even big leading galleries have closed down, you know?
Yeah.
It must be so tough.
Yeah. And maybe, you know, I have so much admiration. I would not want to be a gallerist, especially now. But I think the great thing is that the art world won't stop. It will just reconfigure. And then you have to sort of be astute and find your place within that. Which, you know, Pearl, come on. You've seen, you know, oscillations, you've seen contractions, you've seen expansions.
No, okay. It's true, because high and low, I mean, every economy, there's up and low. But this time it's extremely very difficult because no one actually can see the end, can see the light. So that is why people has been talking about it. People doesn't want to admit about it.
Mm.
But art fairs, they have suspended several apps.
Yeah, and the Taipei one is actually quite surprising.
Which is true because it reflects the economy.
Mm. And people were very excited about Taipei and like the collectors that were being built there. I totally appreciate that. And then we talk about, you know, Singapore, which you're very familiar with. Like there's you have these moments. The art world is just so fantastic about doing the hype. And because it's such a unregulated world and nothing's verified, like all these sales reports, I mean, dealers could be plucking these numbers out of thin air.
Absolutely.
And I suspect some of them do.
Absolutely.
But there's no authority, like there's no kind of financial services authority to say, you know, this is not, you know, you're inflating your business. And I mean, that's also what is very attractive about the art world, isn't it? That it's still relatively lawless.
Okay. Your book. You're wonderful in it. Every time I WhatsApp you, you would say to me, I'm coming to London. I'm coming to Central London to do research on my book. Tell me more about I know you're curious, you love India. What is this book about?
So this book is, as someone described it, it's my life's work, which hopefully it's not, because I want to be doing more work after this. But it's a book that Yale have commissioned. And so it's a university press, but interestingly, and what I appreciate is that they want it for a general audience.
Not for academics.
No, like it's with the academic rigor, as they say, but for a general audience, because what you find, and when I do my research for my podcast and things, is that in so many parts of the world, there are no kind of art history books. There's no sort of, there isn't a one kind of continuous narrative. And I recognize the problematics of that as well, but it's going to be a sort of short dip into Indian art. So someone can pick it up and hopefully go on this wonderful story. Oh, I mean, I work on work, so a big, like maybe a bit kind of that size-ish.
Because Indian art is very profound. I mean, there are so many, you know, so many regions.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of history.
Yeah.
So you may want to have volume one and volume two, volume three.
Yeah. I mean, I know. And like the way it's going, it will be an extended project. But it's trying to condense that actually is very hard because for every sort of paragraph I will have read, you know, papers and papers and papers and books and things.
So when did this Indian art start? Is it old?
Oh, yeah, I'm starting from prehistory. So some of the the first cave paintings.
It's not enough. You have to have volumes.
Yeah. But what I've got to keep is that it's to keep someone engaged. Like, I've been stuck, I've done my time in academia. Those books are not the type of thing that you want to take on holiday with you, that's for sure. And, like, hopefully this can be a type of book that you pick up and, you know, maybe as a student who's curious about something you might have talked about, they'll pick it up and be like, oh, wow, and then they'll want to go on to more. So that's always my intention, to, like, open something up and that hopefully it will lead people on these paths.
Amazing. You've been writing for all the magazines, all the newspaper and all that. How did it all start?
Because I wrote to people asking them if I could write about Indian art. And then I started writing for Art Asia Pacific, which is an amazing magazine. And then I wrote to more people and I wrote to more people and I just kept on sort of knocking on doors saying, can I write for you? And it's quite hard because, you know, if you look at the pages of the newspapers and magazines here, they're very much London-centric. Like, you might get something in Edinburgh, but the meat of it is London-centric. So I'm always, like, thrilled when I can write about things from other parts of the world in these publications.
I was very impressed when I saw all these media you've been writing.
Mm.
You've been writing for.
Yeah, it's kind of, you have it, I think. Like, when you found your thing and you just want to go for it and, like, you know.
Your passion.
Yeah, and, like, I think, again, like, most people that you would speak to on this podcast, it's like, you're just going for it. Like, everything is kind of framed around what you get to make your living from.
Absolutely.
It's amazing. It's really amazing.
Cleo, what a nice session that I have with you. A nice talk, a nice podcast. We will have to have lunch again.
I would love
to. And we will explore more. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.